So, we're going to go on to case number 3. And that is Appeal 12-2979, Sam's Hotel Group versus Enverins, Inc., and it's Mr. Nelson. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Brett Nelson. I'm here for Sam's Hotel. Defendant appellee is Enverins. And we're here about a total failure of the design of a six-story hotel. The architect failed to design the hotel for wind shear, and he failed to adequately design the foundation for the hotel. As a result, as the building neared completion, it was condemned and ordered demolished by the local building department. The issue for this court is a narrow one. It is just whether the limitation of liability provision in the contract that was drafted by the architect is enforceable to prevent the architect's liability for his own negligence. Under Indiana law, it's not. And the reason is because the clause does not specifically and explicitly reference the architect's own conduct. And under Indiana law, it has to in order to make a knowing and willing agreement to the provision.
Let me tell you what my question is. In requiring explicit language for indemnification clauses in negligence actions, it would seem that the Indiana courts have reasoned that the traditional understanding of such clauses is that they apply to third-party claims, so that the court requires explicit language in order to depart from what really is the traditional understanding and extend the application to first-party claims. Those considerations are absent in breach of contract claims, so that by its nature, it necessarily applies to the parties to the contract.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. And the reason why is because a breach of contract can mean a number of things. It can mean a refusal to perform, or in this case, in lots of service cases, it can be negligent performance of the services that you had contracted to provide.
But here, isn't the only remaining claim that for breach of contract?
Right. So if the question is cause of action versus underlying conduct, if you want to draw a line and say, well, no, you brought the cause of action under breach of contract as opposed to a tort negligence, we're done. But if the principle is what you're doing is looking at the underlying conduct, which I think is what not just the indemnity cases but Powell and the other exculpatory cases say, you're looking at negligent conduct. You're looking at what the person did as opposed to what box the lawyers put it in.
But see, what I'm not understanding, I guess, is what is ambiguous about the inclusion of breach of contract in the limitation of liability clause.
So a couple of things, Your Honor. First, the clause itself says to the fullest extent permitted by law. So that acknowledges that there are some limitations, and in Indiana the limitation is if you're talking about your own negligent conduct, you have to say so explicitly. So here it's a breach of contract case, but the conduct at issue is negligence. So the reason why, I guess what Enverins might say or what the court might be thinking is, well, who else is going to be breaching this contract besides Enverins? And the answer is only the parties to the contract can breach the contract, but the negligence can be, and in this case could have been and allegedly was, according to Enverins, on behalf of a number of different people. This is a four-phase contract, and in each of the four phases, there are other parties involved. So the first phase is a design phase where there are drawings put together and you have to take into consideration the requirements of the franchisee. Second phase is construction drawings. In both of those phases, as it happens, Enverins was working with a company called Nucon who supplied steel panels and a flooring system, and their engineers. Enverins' view all the way through trial was it was those rascals in Nucon and DSI that failed to design the building properly. And so this clause would probably have been adequate if that was the only negligence at issue, if it had only been negligence by DSI and Nucon, if Enverins itself didn't have causative negligent conduct.
Yeah, okay. See, I think you've conflated two issues by claiming that negligent conduct was the cause of the breach. but the cause of action should control.
Environs agrees with you. The reason why that's not correct, you can look at the district court's findings in this case about what the breach of contract was. And it wasn't a deliberate infliction of harm on SAMT. It wasn't a refusal to perform. If you look at Judge Pratt's findings, she said that Environs failed to design the building for wind shear. It failed to properly design the foundation. It gave incomplete plans to the state and to DSI and NewCon. Its conduct at issue was negligent. Now, Powell took the Thomas case and applied it to exculpatory clauses. And there have been at least three opportunities. The first was in Marsh for the Supreme Court of Indiana to weigh in on this if it chose to, but it denied transfer all three times with respect to the Indiana Supreme Court weighing in expressly about whether Powell got it right. So from the Avant case, the Shelley and Sands case, and the Marsh v. Dixon case, you can infer that at least things were not so wrong that the Indiana Supreme Court felt compelled to fix it when it was presented with the opportunity three different times. Your Honor's understanding with respect to the policy reasons on indemnity clauses and the policy reasons on exculpatory clauses are the same. The problem is that to require one party to bear the burden of the other party's negligence is an unusual burden, a harsh burden is what Indiana courts say, and one that would not be lightly accepted. And so in order to make sure that that acceptance is knowing and willing, there has to be clear and unequivocal or specific and explicit reference to the underlying conduct.
Mr. Nelson, if I understand your position correctly, if the key sentence here had had the pronoun its or the word environs added to it, that would have solved the problem, right?
That would have been a bare minimum first step, right.
That would have been legally sufficient under your theory, correct?
If reading the clause made it clear to the reader that we were talking about environs own negligence, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. The clause assumes liability that would otherwise apply, correct?
I beg your pardon?
The clause assumes a limit on liability that would otherwise be imposed, correct?
Correct.
So let me go back to your rhetorical question. Who else could it have been talking about here whose negligence would have made Environs liable to SAMS?
So one example is Environs was supposed to, or said, there was testimony that Environs was involving an engineer in the process. If the engineer had been negligent and Environs had been directing it, Environs could have had liability for that mistake. Sued in this case,
third party's negligence that
under Environs control
brought, that Environs brought into the transaction.
There could have been a claim, correct, that Environs they drew a design.
And how would that be a breach of contract by Environs?
It would have been a breach of performing the design in a workmanlike manner as it was required to do.
But it would still be a wrong for which Environs was legally responsible.
Yes.
Right?
So in this case, we actually sued DSI, NewCon, and Environs initially while we were trying to sort out what happened. And we determined, and Environs didn't agree with us, that in DSI and NewCon probably didn't have liability here.
You know, SAMS is a sophisticated business entity. The contract was one that it had used before. You know, there can't be any concern that it lacked an understanding or lacked knowledge of the limitation of a liability clause. And what you've got is the language of the clause includes a breach of contract. And so doesn't sort of common sense say, well, it does, and thus it limits damages for this breach of contract action.
The problem is that the language of the clause and its circumstances in the contract need to draw attention to the fact that you're doing something unusual, that you're accepting responsibility for somebody else's negligence. If you look at the clause, it's on appendix page 44. It's in a paragraph that starts with a sentence about termination, adds a sentence regarding the scope of work that the...
You'll forgive me, but none of it matters. You signed it.
We did sign it, right? And the point is, everybody who has addressed this in an indemnification context or an exculpatory context, has signed it. That's not the question. The question is, does the language put them on notice of what they've signed so that the acceptance was knowing and willing? And
let us hope that you're always on notice of what you sign. I'm not always, but let's hope you are.
If I could just ask one more question before you break. Apart from indemnification cases, where there are certainly pretty significant differences, what is the Indiana case that you think really ties our hands here and predicts that the Indiana Supreme Court would rule in your favor?
So there's a couple, but the one that I like the best is the State Group Industrial v. Murphy. This is a breach of contract claim. It has a limitation of liability provision in the contract that's very similar to ours. There was a breach of contract and a fraudulent breach of contract claim in that case.
Thank you.
Powell and the three other cases that address the issue also are helpful to us. Thank you.
And we asked you a lot of questions, so I'm going to give you some rebuttal time. Okay. Mr. Bishop.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Michael Bishop on behalf of the Appellee Environs. This is a simple breach of contract case, freedom of contract case, between two sophisticated businessmen.
Who was responsible for drafting the language, you know, that's at issue?
It was Environs, after negotiations. There was a series of negotiations, particularly on this case. The record will show that there was back and forth negotiations to come up with the price and the scope. And there was another case back in 1999 between the same two parties. They've done this project twice, different type of hotel, but it's a hotel. And the record is replete with information that the principal for Sam's, Mr. Lacani, was he holds a degree in an MBA in finance from the Kelly School of Business. He has an executive certificate from Dartmouth. So he's built three hotels from the ground up.
I hope you're not trying to suggest anything about Dartmouth versus the IU Kelly Business School.
No, but I think that, you know, somebody ought to send Dartmouth a copy of the brief because it's, you know, called venerable. And
I think that this case, really, it's all about the reality of the construction world.
Speaking of the reality, is that something that I was wondering about? Is it unusual to have such a damages restriction in a contract for architectural services where, you know, negligent work can really result in significant damages, like pulling the building down? That's pretty tough.
Yes, it is not unusual. In fact, that's what the negotiations are all about, to come up to a fair way of assigning risk. And a construction project is a series of layers of contracts and layers of relationships with general contractors, subcontractors, all of whom are negotiating how to share the risk, whether it's by performance bond, insurance, limitation clauses. But I think the interesting distinction in this case is that they negotiate a specific price, $70,000, for which Environs would be responsible. And because this is a strict economic loss case, negligence really goes out the window. The Indiana Supreme Court spoke very clearly on this issue in the library case, Indianapolis library case, that for strict economic loss, which this case is, you may not recover under a theory of tort. So negligence issues are completely gone in this case. We're strictly looking at a breach of contract. So when you look at indemnification or exculpation, those are all tort theories. And another distinction between exculpation clauses and indemnification clauses is that they are open-ended. There's no specific dollars. I'll exculpate myself up to $70,000 or $100,000. I exculpate myself, period, for conduct. And an indemnification clause, I agree to indemnify you for whatever your loss is, not $100, not $70, but it's unlimited. That's how those clauses work. This is not that type of clause. It's a negotiated price for the amount of service. So the architect and the owner agreed that your risk for this project is $70,000, regardless of what happens here. And that's exactly what this case is about.
Is it safe to say, Mr. Bishop, that your theory then has no application, for example, to consumer cases?
Correct. It would have no application. This is a negotiated a construction commercial matter between two sophisticated people.
Can I back up for a second? I guess I'd been wondering whether this was a form contract or kind of a stock phrase from the American Institute of Architects or some similar group. Is that where this came from?
No, I wish I could say that my client was that sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Environs drafted this document, and in fact, if you compare Exhibit 1, which was the contract in this case, to Exhibit 202, which was the contract in the 1990 case for the other hotel, the language is almost identical. So he took the contract from 1999 and changed some of the scope because there was an additional phase, I think, in the contract that's before this court. And the price is certainly different because he was doing a lot more work. So, but essentially, the two contracts are the same if you put them together. The limitation of damage clause, the language is almost identical.
Is there evidence in this record of negotiation over that clause, or more, is it just over the rest of the contract more generally?
I think the record would show that the negotiations went back and forth between the scope of services to be provided. Some were being put in, taken out, and so it was really how much work was Environ supposed to do, how many site visits were being required, and that's how they came up with the price. In fact, if you look at Exhibit 1, it refers back to the contract that was done in 1999, and Mr. Licani was confirming with Environs in writing that, well, this is just like or similar to the project we did in 1999, and they said, yeah. At trial, he said he read it, he understood it, he signed it. There was never any evidence introduced, parole evidence, to construe an ambiguous document. We don't have that situation here. So it was very straight up. It's a very straight up matter. So I see that my time is up.
Well, you actually have another minute.
If you're happy to sit down, we're happy to have you. If there's no further questions, I'll sit down.
Let me just ask you one, Mr. Bishop. As you review the Indiana case law on this subject, do you see any differences between the way the Indiana Supreme Court and the Indiana Court of Appeals have approached these issues?
No, in fact, the Indiana Court of Appeals just last December in Geller v. Kinney, which was cited by the appellants in their reply brief, is a great case. Again, they're talking about there was a negligence issue, but they took great pains to discuss the fact that the commercial standards of negotiating contracts, coming up with a bargain, sharing the risk. They looked at the Fresh Cut case, which was the first case in Indiana from the Supreme Court that set up a standard to see whether or not this was appropriate public policy-wise. But the library case, again, I think is exceptionally well-reasoned opinion by Judge Sullivan that covered this specific issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, there is no evidence anywhere that this provision in the contract was negotiated or even discussed. Mr. Bishop, I think, got it right when he said that the elements of the negotiation related to price and the scope of work. The fact that there was a prior contract 7 years earlier with a similar, not exactly the same, but a very similar limitation of liability provision that never came into question doesn't matter. Mr. Bishop conceded that his view matches mine, that there's no reason to think the Indiana Supreme Court is going to do this differently than the Court of Appeals in Indiana. And, of course, that's your job, is to predict what the Indiana Supreme Court is going to do. Powell says same standard for exculpatory clauses and indemnification clauses. The state group case says even where you have, quote-unquote, sophisticated parties, you're looking at the same standard. The sophistication
state,
issue,
state,
I think.
Did state group, that was the one involving criminal conduct, right?
Well, sort of. It involved fraud and a request for. The answer is yes.
But
the request
wrong,
for civil damages for criminal acts, civil damages for fraud. The sophistication issue, I think, is a red herring. Sophistication matters when you're talking about unconscionability. And Judge Hamilton, when you asked about, well, is there a difference between consumer stuff and commercial party stuff, I think that there is probably there with respect to the unconscionability argument, but there is no difference with respect to the words that you have to use to make sure that this is a knowing and willing assent. The one other point that I wanted to make, I know I've got very limited time and I thank you for it, is the Trimble case. It's a phone book case. And they don't actually talk about this specific and explicit issue. But they do say that limitation of liability clauses are a type of exculpatory clause. That's on page 1129. It's 700 Northeast 2nd, 1129. So the Supreme Court has given every indication that limitation of liability clauses should be treated the same as exculpatory clauses. I had one more. I'm really sorry. Give me one.
That's okay. I don't want you.
Take a breath.
Yeah, it's rough. Believe me. I remember. Yes.
Judge Hamilton, I think you asked if this was a common thing in construction contracts or architectural contracts for there to be a limitation of liability provision. It is, and it can be done right. All you have to do is add a little bit of language. The burden on the architect is trivial compared to the burden that's being imposed on the person that is releasing him from liability. We've cited a number of different, I think 46 different cases, Your Honor, with different language, some that work, some that don't work. The standard is the same according to Powell for exculpatory and indemnity clauses, and that standard wasn't met here.
All right. Thanks to everyone. And the case will be taken under advisement. Drive carefully.